evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Monday, July 1st, 2024. The South Sudan talks in Nairobi appears to have stalled.
This has created a situation where nobody can see exactly what was the objective of the talk, what is the desired goal, what is the timeline, and what would be the outcome.
And community members in Eastern Equatorial State and the diaspora contribute money for road construction.
Instead of going through by Uganda, why don't we open this road so that when the road is open, now instead of selling the goods to Uganda, we can bring the goods to Juba. We also will reduce the economic crisis that we have also in South Sudan.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The peace talks in Nairobi between holdout rebel groups and the South Sudan government appears to be facing challenges. Some of the stakeholders are reported to be hurrying to remove sticky issues so that a final agreement is signed. Jock Madujo, co-founder of the SAD Institute, recently visited the venue of the talks, and he tells me that delegates at the talks have not made progress on some of the important issues.
My reading of those talks was that there was unspoken objectives from the part of the government of Juba, from the part of the mediator, and those objectives turn out to clash with what transpired when the government, the mediator, and all the other stakeholders who are participating in the Tumaini initiative came out with their positions. And so this has created a situation where nobody can see exactly what was the objective of the talk, what is the desired goal, what is the timeline, and what would be the outcome when these talks have been ended. Let me just mention one thing that is almost like a monkey wrench thrown into the situation, and that is when the peace talks were initiated, of course it was supposed to be a continuation or a extension of the process of the Catholic mission San Egidio in Rome, which had stalled, and that people would pick up from where San Egidio left off. But it turned out that more parties joined the talks. There is something called People's Coalition for Civil Action. There are civil society groups. There are women's groups, youth groups, academics, and other stakeholders, as they call them. When they were thrown into that mix, the whole process moved away from the initial objective, which was to try to bring the three non-signatories to the 2018 peace process, including Real SPLM, Paul Malong's SSUF, Boy Rolnyang, and perhaps to bring Thomas Cirilo of NAS, and maybe Simon Gadwich of SLMIO Kidgwang. They were all supposed to join that process. But now it turned out that there are more people who became stakeholders in that process. And those new stakeholders who showed up in all this training came up with ideas, and that instead of another power-sharing agreement, we need an overhaul of the state, including what they call a constitutional conference.
What is wrong with that? What is wrong with that proposal?
Well, what is wrong with that proposal is that Juba seems to feel blindsided, because what they came to Nairobi for was to simply grab three or four people, bring them to Juba, and incorporate them in the government, and they will not have anything else to do. And the status quo prevails. That was the thinking. But now, the new proposals about overhauling the entire system, restructuring the state, meeting with UNOVIN, South Sudanese in a constitutional conference, and putting the constitutional conference before everything else, because basically that is what is wrong with the country, the government was not, it didn't seem ready to answer to those fundamental issues of what is wrong with the country in the first place. Because the government in Juba simply wants to bypass all the questions that South Sudanese have about why are we here as a country. These are questions they don't have answers for, even though they know these are questions that need to be answered.
Let's look at the other stakeholders who were included in the mix. I'm reliably informed that two have been kicked out of their talks because of their erratic behavior at the talks. And I'm also reliably informed that some have nothing to put on the table. I mean, why would you invite somebody who has nothing to offer in a very serious talks?
Well, first of all, I don't think it is right to characterize those who are kicked out of the talks as people who have nothing to offer. Instead, I would say these people, because they were party to some of these groups, but disagreed within those groups and split, and therefore those who stayed in the mainstream of those parties, let us say Paul Malong, South Sudan, United Front, United Army, had some people who were members in it, but when the disagreement happened within SSUF, those people broke away, and they were now saying that they should also be represented at the talks. And at the initial phase, they were invited. But then those mainstream parties that were left campaigned for their splinter groups, for their breakaway groups not to be included. So it really boils down to not lack of anything to offer, as you put it, but because those mainstream leaders who are left don't want them back at the talks, because should the power sharing agreement come back up as a negotiating point, people like General Paul Malong don't want to negotiate to give jobs and positions to their split away groups. I think that is really the issue.
You know, they say the past informs the future. Since 2015, all the peace agreements that have been signed in 2015, 2018, all centered around power sharing, as opposed to really peaceful resolution. Why is power so important to the people of South Sudan?
This is an excellent question. This is really the crux of the matter, Tanza. This is the fundamental problem of South Sudan, which is that when some individuals who have been powerful in the past, whether they were in the SPLM, SPLA, or whether they were party to the event that brought about the Artigulu, or post-CPA power arrangement, the accommodation of various militia groups, the Big Tent, as it was called, all of them saw that power sharing is the only way that they can be big military officers, they can be ministers, they can be vice presidents, they can be something. It's power sharing. That they were so much interested in power that they had to sell their military powers in exchange for power. And if they were not given power, they would stay out of the government and they would cause problems. They would create mayhem, they would create violence, they will remain as a militia force, making a life miserable for the people of South Sudan. This has been the fundamental setup of this country from the get-go.
That's Jogmadu Jog, co-founder of the SAD Institute. He spoke with me from Juba earlier today. Members of the Western Equatorial Legislative Assembly have been on a long recess, sparking reaction from activists and some residents who are asking the lawmakers to return to work and enact laws. The Speaker of the Assembly says there is no money for running the Assembly's business. Matias Samuel Timoteo reports for VOA from Yambio.
Western Equatorial State Legislative Assembly has been a 4-month recess, sparking reactions across the state. Speaker Wakile Charles says the state assembly will open sometime in mid-July because the state governor allegedly told her to wait for salary.
Now we are approaching the remain for us some months to go for election, preparation for election. These few months, I'm sure, coming to the middle of July, we will be opening officially. And we are supposed to pass some laws which can guide us and also will make our community very happy that there is a law that guides them to do everything, especially like we have our children, we have our women who are suffering. We need to have laws in place.
She says, past the governor's speech into a state policy and the conduct of business regulation of the assembly.
So we are praying that since we are going to resume, at least let that spirit of cooperation between the executive and the parliament come so that we can provide the services to our people according to their expectation.
Mbembe Otore, lawmaker representing Ezo County of Western Equatoria State, says residents of the state need security and peaceful environment.
Our people need peace, and we are pledging that this state becomes peaceful, and then the country at large, and then the things move smoothly. We summon people to advise them, to know from them where they have come, where they have reached with their program, because each minister is supposed to have a program which he is following.
He alleged that some state executives do not respect the state assembly, making their work very difficult. Monita Bita, director of the non-profit African Women Help Organization, says the state lawmakers should get back to work.
We are talking about conducting elections in December.
If we are talking about conducting elections in December, why are we still home? We are supposed to be back now in the parliament, talking to people, creating awareness of the importance of the election to us as citizens. There is nothing coming back from the lawmakers in this state. So I think it is important to open up the parliament in order for people to go about their businesses, talking to their citizens about elections.
Western Equatoria State Legislative Assembly took time off for recess in April and was supposed to reopen in June. For VOA News, I am Matthias Samuel Timatio in Yambio, Western Equatoria State.
From Western Equatoria, we move to Eastern Equatoria, where communities from Pajok in Magui County and the diaspora contributed money to start paving a 32-kilometer road from Alia to Poge Ngomoromo, easing transportation to the border with Uganda. Community leaders say traveling from Magui County to Ngomoromo has been very difficult during rainy season. For VOA News, Kaltuma Vanessa reports from Torit.
Donation from members of the Pajok community in South Sudan and in the diaspora collected $35,000 to pave a 32-kilometer road from Alia to Poge, Ngomoromo in Eastern Equatorial State. Richard Omony Violent, chairperson for the road initiative, says waiting for the government to rebuild the road would have added more challenges for residents who depends on trade with Uganda. He says the repaired road could open up market to farmers in South Sudan and Uganda.
Because of the bad road, our farmers can able to bring their goods to be sold in Magui, from Magui reach to Torit, from Torit you come to Juba. It's not easy. So what happened? The Uganda people, they just enter through that side. They buy our crops and everything they buy from there. They take Uganda. From Uganda, they come back through Lumule again to come and sell for us with a high price. Instead of going through by Uganda, why don't we open this road? So that when the road is open, now instead of selling the goods to Uganda, we can bring the goods to the Juba. We also reduce the economic crisis that we have also in South Sudan.
Louis Lobong Lojore, governor of Eastern Equatorial State, says the community and the state government are responsible for developing parts of South Sudan.
It is we who are supposed to build our schools, to build our roads, to build our health facilities. Other people think that is the government supposed to do so. Yes, the government can come in, but in reality, it is supposed to be the community.
Lojore is arguing the people of South Sudan to consider paying taxes because the revenue from oil production alone cannot sustain development in the country. Oil output and export have dropped sharply because of the war in Sudan, which has cut off access to the port of Sudan.
We are not paying taxes. Our community are not making roads, building roads, because when we came in, we signed a CPA, we found the money from the oil, and we started using it. We did not know that one day this money will get finished. Now the truth is that the money from the oil got finished. The oil is not anymore flowing as before. And that is why you are hearing that Nasi Masar of Gurus, I mean months. And that is why you are hearing that we are not able to afford to make roads.
The United Nations says only about 2% South Sudan, 20,000 kilometers of roads are paved, and 52% of these paved roads are in despair. In 2011, the United States Agency for International Development funded the construction of the 192-kilometer Juba-Nimule Road, the first highway in South Sudan. Journalist Thomas Orari, with the Voice of Eastern Equatoria State, contributed audio in this story. For VOA News, I am Kaltuma Vanessa in Torit, Eastern Equatoria State.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, refugees are helping refugees. Find out why and how after the break.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. After fleeing conflict in Somalia, Mohamed Matan overcame many challenges growing up in Kenya's Dadaab refugee camp. Today, he's helping young refugees learn digital skills so that they could lead to a brighter future. VOA reporter Ahmed Hussein met Matan in the Gahali section of Dadaab and has this story.
Here in the Gahlei refugee camp in northeastern Kenya, 30-year-old Mohamed Matan is teaching young refugees digital skills and hopes that those skills can lead to better opportunities.
We teach both basic and advanced computer program and other skills like freelancing, data entry, web development and web design to help refugee youth access online jobs.
Matan's parents fled Somalia in 2001, when he was just 7 years old. Matan initially started doing manual work, but later he enrolled in a UN-supported digital skills training program in the camps. Now, Matan hopes the skills he's teaching will help young refugees stay out of trouble.
I started this initiative to help youth in the refugee camps avoid drug abuse and other activities that will compromise safety and security. Once a refugee is unemployed, they tend to engage in harmful activities, so we decided to empower them.
Students are able to attend different classes during the week, while some opt for weekend sessions. Abdurrahman Hassan is one of the trainees and says the program has benefited him.
We have learned digital skills like freelancing online, software and other computer skills that will enable me to access opportunities online and earn a living. We have benefited a lot.
Matan currently offers free classes to over 70 students in the refugee camp and aims to expand the program. However, He says there are some difficulties and needs assistance.
Some of the challenges we face are using old computers and the internet is slow. But if we get support, we hope to expand and improve the machines to keep up with the changing digital technology.
Kenya is home to nearly 800,000 refugees and asylum seekers, primarily from Somalia and South Sudan, according to the United Nations. Trained refugees such as Mohamed Matan are optimistic that the skills they have gained here will pave the way for greater opportunities ahead. Ahmed Hussein for VOA News, Dadaab Refugee Camp, Kenya.
From Dadaab, we move back to Kenya, where presidential candidates Joe Biden and Donald Trump are back on the campaign trail following their first debate last week. Biden's sometimes struggling performance in that debate has some members of his political party looking at who might replace him as their nominee. VOA correspondent Scott Stans has more.
Donald Trump and Joe Biden were back on the campaign trail after last week's first debate, with Biden looking to reassure supporters that he's ready for a second term following an at times halting debate performance.
I give you my word as a Biden, I would not be running again if I didn't believe with all my heart and soul I can do this job. Because quite frankly, the stakes are too high.
Biden fundraising over the weekend was another chance for his campaign to push back against concern among some in the Democratic Party that his debate stumbles mean they should be looking for a new candidate. University of Virginia Center for Politics Director Larry Sabato.
If there were a new, vigorous, younger Democratic nominee, I think people would take that opportunity in a minute to keep Trump out.
Trump said the debate showed this election is a choice between strength and weakness.
The question every voter should be asking themselves today is not whether Joe Biden can survive a 90-minute debate performance, but whether America can survive four more years of crooked Joe Biden in the White House.
Trump told a post-debate rally that he believes Biden will stay in the race.
Many people are saying that after last night's performance that Joe Biden is leaving the race. But the fact is, I don't really believe that because he does better in polls than any of the Democrats they're talking about.
Among the Democrats who some in their party are talking about possibly replacing Biden are his running mate, Vice President Kamala Harris, Governor of the key swing state of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, California Governor Gavin Newsom, Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker. None of those Democrats is calling for replacing Biden. Switching candidates before their party's August convention would require Biden dropping out. Again, Larry Sabato.
They would have to go to the White House and try to convince him, and he will be tough to convince. And they'll also have to try to convince Joe Biden, and that may be even tougher.
The First Lady told a post-debate rally that her husband showed he's America's best choice.
What you saw last night on the debate stage was Joe Biden, a president with integrity and character. Who told the truth, and Donald Trump told lie after lie after lie.
Early post-debate polling by CBS News shows most Democrats believe Biden should still be their nominee. It's the political party's conventions that will have greater impacts with voters than debates, says Marquette University political science professor Julia Azari.
Sort of state-of-the-art research in political science about what sorts of events seem to drive vote intent and become increasingly sort of predictive of how people will vote in November. The conventions matter, but debates don't.
The Biden campaign held a post-debate conference call with Democratic National Committee members about the coming convention. Some committee members on the call told the Associated Press that it was an overly rosy assessment of Biden's path to re-election and largely ignored criticism of his debate performance. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
That's all we prepared for you this Monday, July 1st, 2024. We now leave you with the song Intumia Junubin by Emmanuel. We have been listening to Emmanuel Lasso and the song Intumia Junubin. I'm your host, John Tanz, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Helen, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In introducing the latest U.S. report on the status of international religious freedom, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said its purpose is to advance the U.S. vision for a future where everyone is able to choose and practice their beliefs.
Respecting religious freedom reinforces other rights, like the right to speak freely, to assemble peacefully, the ability to participate in politics. Protecting this universal right empowers people to express themselves, to live up to their full potential, to contribute fully to their communities.
Yet today, religious freedom remains under threat for millions, said Secretary Blinken.
Pew Research Center recently found that government restrictions on religion had reached their highest global level since tracking began back in 2007. Today, governments around the world continue to target individuals, shutter places of worship, forcibly displace communities, and imprison people because of their religious beliefs.
Some countries, he noted, restrict certain types of religious dress. Others make it mandatory. Some governments are reaching beyond their borders to target individuals because of their faith and their advocacy for religious freedom.
In every region, people continue to face religious-based violence, religious-based discrimination, both from governments and their fellow citizens. They may be shut out of schools, denied jobs, harassed, beaten, or worse.
Violent extremist groups also target people based on their religion. Secretary Blinken pointed to the June attack on churches and a synagogue in Russia's Dagestan region, in which police, civilians, and a priest were killed. He noted that since Hamas's horrific terrorist attack on Israel on October 7th and the subsequent conflict in Gaza, both anti-Semitism and Islamophobia have increased significantly across the globe. Documenting such abuses, standing up against hatred and brutality, defending the right to religious freedom for every person are central to U.S. foreign policy. Ultimately, said Secretary Blinken, this work is about protecting an essential part of what it means to be human, the ability to explore something bigger than ourselves. The right to choose what we believe also allows us to learn from those who are different than us and celebrate all that we have in common. Quoting the religious scholar Houston Smith, Secretary Blinken declared, "If we take the world's enduring religion at their best, we discover the distilled wisdom of the human race."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.